Thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions based on that testimony? Okay, if everyone will bear with me a moment, I am just double checking my list here. I have to bear with me. I know it's boring. And remind everybody that if you would like to testify, please message me via the chat function. One moment, I'm getting to the bottom here.
And just a reminder, anybody who's on the phone who wants to provide public comment, please text 781-870-0432. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I double checked my list and.
Gemma, activa su micrófono, por favor. No podemos oírte.
Just give us one moment. Okay. Stephanie, I have unmuted you.
Thank you very much. My name is Stephanie Gates, and unlike, well, I've only listened to some of the testimony, but I'm a parent. Hi, Angela, it's nice to see you there. I've spoken with Angela. I'm testifying because I have a very different perspective than almost all of you. I'm speaking from the trenches, so to speak. I'm a mother of a child who in second grade was repeatedly sexually abused in a peer-on-peer situation. He, along with at least five other children, were victims of an alleged perpetrator at a public elementary school. I am here because of the total failure of all the mandated reporters who should have protected the children. The pediatrician that I went to and I told as soon as my son reported, failed me. She never reported, although she was a mandated reporter. The school administrators never reported my son as a victim. The police officer, the SRO, never reported my son as a victim until she was told to do so by Essex County District Attorney's Office. When I went to the district, Essex County District Attorney's Office, when I figured out that all these people had failed in their mandated reporting requirements, particularly the school, I called up the child advocate, Mulhaney is her name, at the Essex County District Attorney's Office and told her. And do you know what? She told me, I can't do anything because the case is closed. So nothing happened there. I specifically wanted to address the mandated reporting penalties, because a lot of people here seem to think that it should be eliminated. I am all for increasing them. And I very, very much think that the penalties should increase, because none of the mandated reporters did what they were supposed to do. I also wanted to address the aspect of the licensing violations for mandated reporters that you guys were mentioning that as an aspect. It was on page 34 and 35 of the commission report, but you were mentioning that as an aspect for further punishment, having the licensing boards go after or penalize the licensee for violating their mandated reporting. And I want to tell you guys that that's not working for me, that I have gone to the Social Licensing Board of Massachusetts, as well as the Nursing Board, because both the school nurse and the social worker, who is the school counselor at my child's elementary school, violated their mandating reporter obligations. And I've gone to both of those boards, and both complaints, although one took 2 years, both complaints have been dismissed for lack of information and or not violating any regulations. That was the nursing one. That was, I was told that they didn't violate any regulations, although I had said she did not do the mandating reporting. That's it. Thank you. One other thing quickly. I did speak with my husband, who is an economist, about possible solutions instead of using the licensing boards, because they're ineffective and have conflicting incentives. We would like to suggest that perhaps the removal of the private liability shields from school committees might be a possibility, since children are in school from kindergarten or preschool through, you know, obligation. They're obligated to be there until age 16 and are frequently the reporters, that if you remove some of their protections, perhaps they will actually report. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gates. I will note that that last suggestion you had hasn't been presented to the commission before, to my knowledge. So if you're interested in submitting that in writing, I think the commission would find that helpful to see that recommendation in writing. You can see on the Mandated Reporter Commission webpage how to do that if you're interested in doing that.
Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Gates? Okay, at this time, I don't have anyone else in the queue who is interested or has identified themselves as being interested in providing testimony. I want to encourage anyone who has not testified yet who is interested, please let me know now. If you are on the phone, you can text 781-870-0432. Again, it's 781-870-0432. I'd like to first take some time to ask the commission members if they have any questions that they hold back in the interest of time that they would like to ask any of the presenters who spoke today. I'm going to give you guys a chance to think about that before I move on to other options. And any commission members who I have not made co-hosts and who cannot unmute themselves, please message me and I will, I'm sure to do that. In the meantime, we have had a request from Ms. Raz, I'm sorry, I don't know if that's how to pronounce your last name, to provide more testimony. I'm gonna shoot it over to Maria right now. Leave it up to you to see if we are going to entertain people adding to their testimony. We have two people now who have identified themselves as interested in adding to their testimony.
I presume that if you have everything already written out, that we would be happy to just take it in written testimony. Because my sense is that for the professionals who are providing oral testimony today, that you probably have all of this written out with references to studies, and we'd be happy to take it in that capacity. I will say that I have a question, and that has to do with, as a result of the situation in Penn State and the U.S. Olympic scandal, many states revised their statutes in order to ensure that both institutions of higher education and coaches who were not necessarily included in other statutes got included. And I'm very curious in terms of whether anyone's done any research in terms of what you are describing as a huge increase in reports coming from institutions of higher education and or recreational sports activities, coming from what we would consider in Massachusetts institutional reporters, rather than the types of reports that impact necessarily families. And just curious if in the research that people have either individually conducted or in the research that the advocates on this call have found evidence of, whether there has been in other states who recently, meaning in the last decade, what I would say is sort of updated their statute, whether you're seeing the equivalent numbers as was to be expected would happen in Pennsylvania, given the magnitude of the scandal.
So I believe that Ms. Raz, you have an answer to that, but if anyone else has an answer to that, please message me so I can unmute you to respond to that. Perhaps Ms. Vaughn will as well, but Ms. Raz, am I correct that you have a response?
I think I have a brief response. I mean, there was just a new article that came out in Pediatrics this month that looked at different states and how they changed their policies and whether what this change did. And it looked at a number of different states that expanded mandated reporting. Michigan, in fact, had hearings and chose not to expand significantly in the aftermath. But what they found was these expansions led to many more reports, but fewer substantiations, and did not end up in successfully identify, I mean, it's a complicated piece, but the bottom line was it did not successfully identify more children at risk of harm just by virtue of casting a broader net. Thank you. I will provide reference.
We have that one. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm on mute. Does anyone else have an answer to that question? Anyone interested in testifying who has not yet testified? Or does any commission member have a question either based off of Maria's question or another question to pose to the people who have testified? It's all quiet at the moment. I'm going to give everybody a couple more moments to think it over. I want to remind everybody on this call that we will be having another public hearing on Saturday, this coming Saturday, the 17th, from 1:30 to 3:30. We will also have interpretation services for that public hearing, and we will be making, we will be using the same process. I do have someone who has not testified yet who is interested in testifying, so give me one moment here. Okay, you are on for 3 minutes.
Hi, good evening. My name is Michelle Lucier. I'm an attorney who practices mostly in Western Massachusetts. I'm a CAFL panel attorney, and I was also, for a brief stint, a legal services attorney representing battered women back in the early 2000s. And what I would like to say in support is that the mandatory reporting laws do have a serious impact, chilling impact on women and children trying to seek help and services. And so I think that any definition of neglect needs to exclude the mere fact of being a victim. The mere fact of being a victim is not neglect. And a mother who seeks out services after having been a victim should not be labeled as a neglectful parent. It's a completely unfair system where you're putting that label on somebody who is not only trying to seek help for herself and her children and trying to navigate this system, in seeking help, but it has a future impact on her as well. And so it's been a pet peeve of mine for many years, seeing women who try to reach out to the police, getting a 51A filed on her because she got hit in front of the children and the children witnessed domestic violence. And that needs to be changed. So if there's going to be a definitional change in what is neglect, then that needs to change. It's not only unfair and traumatizing to the children to be removed from a mother who has been a victim, but it just has it's just wrong. And so I'd ask that you at least look into that definition of neglect and change that, and also train, include training for people who are supposed mandated reporters, that the simple fact that a woman reaches out to you for help, that's not neglect. They're actually protecting their children when they seek help. So that's all. I just have that comment to make.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Does anyone have any questions based on that? I do want to ensure, I want to point everybody to the report that the Mandated Reporter Commission posted for public comment on our website that does go into detail about some of the proposals that have been presented to the commission. I will note within that report, we do note that there is no current definition of abuse or neglect as it relates to mandated reporting. So the issue that the commission is considering is whether there should be a definition and what that definition should entail. It's not, I know there's been some confusion, and I'm not saying that any of our speakers are confused, but I'm putting it out to the group on the call that there has been some confusion about whether or not we're changing a definition. Right now, there is no definition of abuse or neglect that relates to mandated reporting. And so the proposal before the commission is to consider adding a definition and what that definition would entail. So I just wanna clarify that. Does any commission members have any questions or want to ask any questions of our last speaker or any of our previous speakers?
Chrissy, I thought if I could add that there's no statutory definition. Yes. There's a regulatory definition, but nothing currently or policy. DC, there's a definition that DCF uses, but there's nothing in the current statute.
Yes, and I think that's part of some of the complication, which is that DCF does have a regulation that relates to the information that they receive and what they do with that information. But that regulation doesn't have any bearing on mandated reporting. It's what DCF does with the information, and there is no recommendation to alter those regulations. There's no recommendation to alter DCF's own regulations, which is outside, I think, of the Mandated Reporter Commission's sort of purview.
So I have a question for Attorney Lucier. So given that example and clarification that Chrissy and Angela just provided, do you still have cases that would, situations that changes would negatively be, your clients would negatively be affected? Or is it more of a process of another state agency's process?
Can you repeat that, please? Sure. I'm not understanding your question. Do I still have clients who are negatively affected by the mandatory reporting law? Clients who are battered women?
As it relates to, as Chrissy clarified, that it does not currently affect domestic abuse and neglect.
So if I can jump in, maybe I might be able to help.
Great.
I think with the understanding that DCF's regulations would remain as they are, and DCF's guidance in terms of domestic violence would remain as they are, would a definition of abuse or neglect provided to mandated reporters about what they are going to report, would that have a substantial impact on your cases? And I will note also, to complicate matters, the Mandated Reporter Commission is also considering training, which I believe would touch on domestic violence and guidance provided by DCF regarding domestic violence.
Well, I think that a law that it specifically excludes, the mere fact of being a victim should be an exclusion of what is abuse and neglect, just as the mere fact of being impoverished should be excluded in the definition of what is abuse and neglect. So if you're going to create a law that requires more reporting, then you should also be guiding reporters, and I think statutorily guiding them, saying this is not abuse and neglect. So the mere fact, when you get a call as a police officer that a woman has been hit in front of the children, that you're not going to file on that woman. You know, they may file on the abuser, but I have had numerous cases, too many to even think of, where the mere fact of being a victim, that parent was found to be neglectful, because the abuse occurred in front of the children. Numerous, too many to count. I can't even, and children removed because of that. So as legislators, and if you're going to expand the mandatory reporting law, I think that it's very important that you train what is and is not neglect, and exclude, have a definition that it excludes, so that people aren't just filing because of the color of your skin or implicit bias or, you know, I think this commission has to dig deep here. We have a problem here in Massachusetts. We have a big problem in terms of over-reporting, I believe, as it is. And I know that there have been comments that during the pandemic, there's been a decrease in 51As, but I don't think that that's, you know, I understand that everybody's concerned about children not being seen, but I don't think to let the pendulum swing so that you do cast this big net and you bring in people who are trying to seek help. They're looking for help and you're removing their children. Not only does that cause trauma to the parents, but it causes trauma to these kids. Do you know how many kids I have in foster care calling me saying, I want to go home? I want to go home. I can't even count. I can't even tell you what's happening right now. So I guess the short answer is I think that if you're going to legislate carefully. If you're going to cast a big net, that you need to have some exclusions here that protect people who are victims, that protect children from the trauma of being removed from the only parent who sought protection.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Chrissy, I'd like to make a point. The last speaker spoke that we were legislators. Well, we're not legislators, and we aren't legislating. We are a gubernatorial commission that was put together to look at the statute, and through, you know, the chairmanship of the OCA, we will be submitting a report, but then it starts from scratch before the legislature. So even if our recommendations and my recommendations are going to be very much in tune to all this testimony that was heard today, and I want to thank you all for coming today and speaking. But you know, that may not rule the day, controlling what comes out of this commission. But after that, this report is then going to be submitted to the legislature. So I just wanted to clarify that if there was any confusion that we were in some way the final arbiters of this decision.
I appreciate that, Lisa. Yes, I think that's an important distinction. I will note that we've had a request from some people who have already testified to speak on some of these points. One person who is interested in speaking on the domestic violence point, and one person who I'm not sure, but I can follow up in terms of providing further testimony. I'm going to again say, Maria, are we interested in taking further testimony, or perhaps Nina, are you interested in expanding that question regarding domestic violence out to everyone, or was your question directed solely to Ms. Lucier?
If there's someone who wants to add to the issue of when the police respond to a domestic violence case, do they automatically file a 51A against all of the adults as a way of bringing that situation to the attention of the Department of Children and Families in an effort of ensuring that whatever result comes from that incident, that the children are in fact protected. So if you are interested in providing a few minutes to comment on the information that was presented, I will certainly entertain that.
Sorry, just a sec. Gemma, you need to leave your microphone on for the... We can't hear you.
Just hold on.
Yes, great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's on the interpretation piece. Okay, Ms.
No problem.
I'd indicated.
Thank you. Thank you. So I wanted to add to what Michelle was describing around these situations of domestic violence. In addition to the definitional proposals, the proposals around the definition of abuse and neglect, I think another proposal that has specific bearing on this issue is the one that expands the required reports to situations where children are sort of just at risk of abuse or neglect. So another piece of my research that I didn't talk about today focused on interviews with mandated reporters. And so I remember one interview in particular with a domestic violence advocate who worked with domestic violence victims in court in collaboration with the police and with the courts. And she talked about how, the child wasn't necessarily witnessing or exposed to the violence this one time that she was discussing with the victim. But that doesn't mean that the child wasn't there 2 weeks ago when this happened, or this doesn't mean that even if the child was asleep, the child might have been sort of awake under their covers. And so she was sort of really envisioning all of these different ways that the child could have been at risk or might have been at risk, even if there was no actual exposure to domestic violence, which under some regulations constitutes neglect. And so I just wanted to add that point as well to the conversation regarding how expanding our understanding of maltreatment to incorporate these kind of at-risk situations can also bring more domestic violence victims into the system.
Thank you, Ms. Vaughn. And I have one more person who's interested in discussing domestic violence. And I'm gonna ask everybody, I think comments have been to the appropriate length, but if everyone could keep their comments on the domestic violence point as much as possible, I think that would be helpful. And then I think after this presenter, I'm gonna turn it back over to Maria, as I have no other people who are interested in testifying who have not yet testified. So, Mr. Wexler.
Okay, thank you very much. I wanna speak to this because my group's vice president brought a class action lawsuit that made taking children of domestic violence victims illegal in the city of New York. And the New York State Court of Appeals issued a decision saying it is illegal statewide. And the reason for that is because of the overwhelming scientific evidence of how much it hurts children. Yes, witnessing domestic violence can hurt children emotionally. Taking them from the non-offending parent is a far greater trauma. Children think they must have done something terribly wrong and now they are being punished. One of the experts who testified in this suit said, you take a child away in this situation, it's like pouring salt into an open wound. And what we've heard from Ms. Lucier's testimony here today is, in Massachusetts, the policy boils down to, please pass the salt. And the idea that, oh, the police are only making these calls to report everyone so those kindly DCF workers will help everyone, that's exactly the kind of head in the sand attitude that creates a system that tears apart families at a rate 60% above the national average. Understand, DCF isn't viewed as a kindly intervener. DCF is viewed today the way the Massachusetts Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children was viewed in the 1890s, when it was known in poor communities simply as the cruelty. DCF is the new version of the cruelty. And in poor communities of color, they are seen as a police force. And in fact, they have more power than the police. And unleashing DCF to tear away children from battered mothers is a disgrace. The law should be changed to absolutely prohibit it. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Give me one moment.
Chrissy, I'm sending you some info right now.
Oh, thank you very much. Just give me, okay, give me a moment here. I'm gonna have one more person testify on the domestic violence piece. And so I'm asking people now to keep that testimony to under 2 minutes. There you go.
I've already testified. This is Hema Sarng-Siminski from Jane Doe Inc., the Mass Coalition on Sexual and Domestic Violence. And, you know, I just wanted to comment very briefly on the focus on, you know, the police filing of 51As. I mean, that is, it can continue to be an issue, certainly. However, I think for the purposes of this conversation, I think it's really important to elevate that beyond simply police response and filing, because the vast majority of survivors of domestic violence and sexual abuse never come into contact with law enforcement. That's just a reality of survivorship. And so I think the concerns that we raised really look to essentially expanding the field of those who honestly may or may not even come into contact with children, but the field of individuals who might be able to file a 51A without awareness of the intricacies and realities for survivors of sexual and domestic violence, right? Existing providers who are trained and who interact with systems already acknowledge that there are huge gaps in system understanding and societal understanding about these issues. So that's just, let's be mindful that this is beyond simply a police response to particular individuals. This is a broader issue of putting immense power in a number of additional folks and far beyond the sexual and domestic violence. You know, that advocate exemption that was considered is not sufficient. This is bigger than that. So thank you.
Thank you. It would be helpful if I could ask you a question about when you think of the categories that were discussed in the comment, which categories in particular do you think would result in people with no training or understanding of domestic violence that will then, to the words of some of the folks here, open the floodgates? What particular categories are you concerned with?
I'm concerned with the expansion largely for a couple of reasons. I think primarily there's some really good data on the chilling effect that expansions of mandatory reporting have even on individuals' abilities to reach out to their informal networks. There's a 2020 study about that really showed a significant decrease in survivors reaching out to friends or family because, you know, when you begin to look at who's included as a category, whether or not they are acting in their professional capacity, right? if I thought about my network, my community, all of you, right, I think we could identify with the categories proposed a number of individuals in our networks and our circles who would be mandatory reporters. And it's that is the chilling effect that is most, to me, most concerning, that it creates an overall reluctance to talk to anybody, right? Where I think in this study, and I will make sure I include this in our written testimony, you know, a decrease in even speaking to friends or family, right? That is a big piece. And we can go into the individual categories as needed, but that's the primary concern. It's the overall chilling effect.
Thank you very much. I do want to remind everyone to keep their comments as slow and measured as possible. We do have one more person who has identified themselves as wanting to testify who has not testified yet. So they're going to get their full 3 minutes. And there you are. You have 3 minutes.
Good evening. My name is Attorney Hamilton Quiroz. I actually am an attorney on the CAFL panel. I do represent children and parents when children are faced with removal from the home as a result of a 51A filing. And what I'd wanted to really address is build upon what the speaker prior to me, immediately prior to me, was speaking of, in that mandated reporters, I've spoken with, I don't know how many, too many I can count, but they don't understand what happens after that report goes in. And if we're relying on their gut instinct instead of clearer training and criteria, it snowballs for the family. And like my colleagues have said, children are being harmed because they're being removed when services in the home may prevent that removal. We have protections in the law that the department is supposed to present a certain level of evidence. It's very, very easy, very, very easy. And I repeat that on purpose, to remove someone's child temporarily because of a 51A filing. That temporary status for that child can be 2 years, 3 years. For a child who's 2 or 3 years is not so temporary. So my main point, I just wanted to build on the prior speaker, is that we have to consider when we're expanding that net, where that net is going to end, not just in new reports, which is going to take many millions of dollars for a department that's already overworked, when we could use funds to provide the families we have with services so that the children don't have to be removed and the family doesn't have to be fragmented.
Thank you very much. I do want to note for all of our participants here today that we do have a full document on our, I know I sound like a broken record, but a document on our Mandated Reporter Commission website that does detail all of the proposals that the commission is considering or that have been put forward for the commission's consideration. And that does include some substantial proposals regarding training. So I just heard that and wanted to make sure that people had an opportunity or knew to review that document. I do have one more person who has identified themselves as being interested in testifying who has not yet testified. So I'm going to unmute them and give them 3 minutes.
And just a reminder, please, to speak slower so that the translators can translate appropriately. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Amy Merchant. I'm a parent that's involved with DCF currently, and I'm sharing because unfortunately I have had multiple 51As that were filed against me that were unsupported. And during them situations that they were unsupported, my children were removed from me, and it caused a lot of harm for me and my family. It caused my children to be traumatized with, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm sorry. Like, you know, they feared when they came home to me of being removed from me again. Again, they weren't supported. They, you know, I just think there needs to be more attention. You know, who am I supposed to speak to when I am dealing with a situation and be able to feel safe if the children are not at home and stuff, like, how am I supposed to be dealing with certain issues if I don't have nobody to turn to and be able to feel safe that my kids are not going to be removed from me if I'm dealing with an issue that my kids are not at home, but I'm in fear of speaking because DCF has the upper hand. And, you know, no matter who it is that's doing a report, you know, they're going to listen to that person and have my kids removed from me. Therefore, I'm afraid of seeking proper treatment for me or my children out of the fear of what DCF is going to do. I think there needs to be, you know, like more training on, you know, where do they remove the kids at and stuff like that. I'm sorry, I'm a little anxious about this. So I didn't really, I don't know, I'm sorry. But I think
that- Doing a great job, don't worry, keep going.
Okay, I really think there needs to be a lot better training. Again, you know, like my kids deal with separation anxiety, you know, being removed from me. You know, I want to share one example. We went out one year, we were going trick-or-treating, and I made just a general statement. And when I got home from a nice evening with trick-or-treating with my kids, I had DCF and three police officers waiting for me. And they took my kids for 30 days because there was no lawyers available for my children or anything like that. And when I went in front of the judge, my children were placed right back to me. So there that was 30 days that my kids weren't with me, and we had to deal with the situation, and it caused a lot of harm for all everybody in the family. So I just think there needs to be better training for situations like that. Yeah. So that's all I really got right now. I'm sorry, I came in late, and that's what I have to share. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming forward and sharing your experience. And we were planning on staying till 6:30, so you are not late at all.
So I want to remind people who are solely on the phone that if you're interested in testifying, to please text the number 781-870-4032. Again, 781-870-4032. And I'm going to give everybody a chance to do that. That is how I know that you want to testify. Otherwise, please put your name in the chat if you're participating virtually. Does anyone have any questions for our last presenter?
I don't have any questions, but I just want to thank Amy for coming forward. That took a lot of guts to put her personal situation out in public. But we really thank you, Amy, because it means a lot to hear from people who have been directly impacted.
Okay. I have one. Oh, here we go. All right, I have another person who is interested in testifying. And so they're going to get 3 minutes. And I'll start the clock. If you give me one moment here. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Deborah Berkovitz. I'm testifying as a private citizen. I hadn't intended to testify, but I've been moved by a lot of what I've heard. And I work with parents with substance use issues, and I wanted to share some of the overlap that I'm hearing. With many, many families, what happens when there's power and control, which often for women, they're misusing substances as a response to trauma, current trauma in their intimate relationships and childhood trauma. And they are often using with partners or are being forced to use with partners. And I have seen many, many, many situations in which their partners use the threat of DCF and saying, and you know, that they will tell DCF that they are using even if they're not. And so it's another place where the intersection of intimate partner violence and substance use happens. And also thinking about risk, you know, we do a lot of filing on people because of risk of abuse and neglect when there has been a substance use history, even when there's not current substance use. And so I think, and we have not seen, you know, very good results of that for families, for children or parents. And so, you know, it's certainly something I would have a lot of concerns about. And I think that the reliance on training is misdirected. I just want to say, having been involved in many training efforts in agency level and community level and statewide, doing good quality training for any workforce is very, very difficult. There's a lot of turnover in the kinds of professional positions that we're talking about. I understand that there's a widening beyond just kind of people in their professional capacity, but it sounds great in theory, but it is not actually the kind of safety net when enacting policies that we might hope that it is. And so I think that in a way, in determining policies, we really need to be thinking about if there's no training, if nobody learns how to do this any better, what is it going to look like? And that's kind of working from the margins, because that is actually the reality of what it looks like on the ground. And the one other thing I wanted to say is that, you know, having kids in protective custody isn't a benign experience. And I think we don't talk about that enough when we're having these conversations, that, you know, I've worked with families where there's, you know, an infant might have 10 placements over a 3 or 4 month period. And, you know, a 72-hour hearing might be postponed for months. And so, you know, I just feel like we should be doing a really good job at looking at the research about what expanding mandated reporting might entail, and the experience of other states, because I think that we are not always great in Massachusetts at looking at states that have come before us. You know, I look at what's happened with cannabis, and you know, we didn't learn from Colorado. And so I think those are my comments. I appreciate the willing ear here, and I hope that people take very seriously the potential impacts on children that are not what the intended consequences are. Thanks.
Thank you. I do want to remind our speakers to speak slowly for the interpreters. We do have several interpreters on the line. Does any commission member have any questions based on that last testimony? If not, I have another person who has identified themselves as interested in testifying who has not yet testified. And so I'm going to provide that person with 3 minutes if we're getting better at this. There you are, and you have 3 minutes.
Hi, I did not plan on testifying. Oops, I have got another thing. I did not plan on testifying, but sorry, I am not Joseph Koenig, but my children are now over the age of 18, so I do not feel at risk anymore. And this is going back about 6, 7, 8 years. I'm actually not sure. I would need to check my records. But just to let you know, I had to wait until my youngest turned 18 before I even started speaking on this. And that happened this fall. The particular incident that I would like to actually convey is I was in the middle of a heated custody dispute with a rather controlling person, and I'm not very controllable. And I was reported, DCF showed up at my house with the police. The investigation went on, and investigation went on. They passed it on for a full investigation after the initial one. That one was dismissed immediately. However, after the initial 51A and the initial substantiation, I, despite being discouraged, actively discouraged, I still filed for a fair hearing. I found out actually quite a bit during that fair hearing, because DCF had actually messed up and had not provided me with the appropriate paperwork. So when I actually did the fair hearing, they were told, give her the paperwork now, and they failed to redact a number of things. So DCF actually messed up, but it actually led me to a paper trail. And the particular mandated reporter who worked in collusion with my abusive ex-husband actually turned out to have a reputation of doing this. In fact, I actually was witness to that particular mandated reporter threatening other single mothers with reporting if she did not get compliance to her plans. So that's where we start. I will tell you, I'm going to skip to the end of this, that it took 5.5 years for that complaint to be overturned, for the substantiation to be overturned through the fair hearing process. 5.5 years. Now, mind you, it had already been dismissed by the actual full investigation about 2 months before the fair hearing. However, during the custody dispute, this was actually brought to the attention of the judge. The judge removed the children from my custody based on a very, very flawed investigation, which among other things, just to point out, there is a question, have you ever taken anything like drugs? And this includes Tylenol or Advil. And I said, well, about 8 months ago, I was on a prescription, but I'm not sure what it was. All I remember was off-label, because I was being completely honest, because I didn't know any better. I answered the question truthfully. And in the substantiation for the 51A, it said I was on psychotropic medications and I did not know what for or what it was. So that's the level of error that came in, including the wrong ages of some of my children. In fact, they switched the schools. One of them was attending other schools. It was such a flawed investigation, but the judge used that investigation to remove my children, despite the fact that I was in the middle of a fair hearing process and despite the fact that DCSF had closed the case upon further notice. The children were removed from me. They were put into kinship care. They kept showing up at my house because a couple of them were teenagers. So they actually then put them into DCF care, foster care. Beyond that, the DCF office kept saying, why can't we close this case? I will tell you at this point, my children learned. We actually have code words in the house that say, don't open the door. Don't answer the phone. We actually have code words now. Well, we don't have them anymore because they're 18, but we actually developed code words to say, shut down, don't talk to anybody, hide. Don't talk to your teachers. Don't talk to we talked to the doctor because my doctor was good and she knew us from a young age. That's the effect. It was an unsubstantiated report that resulted in all of this damage. And we did find out later on that this particular mandated reporter had a reputation of using it for coercion. Expanding it to people who don't know any better is a bad idea, period.
Thank you. You are past the 3 minutes, but I'll give you a minute if you want to wrap up, or you can say if you've completed your testimony.
I understand the concept behind mandated reporters, but the fact of the matter is they don't have the training. Their training is how to fill out paperwork. They don't have the understanding of all of the multiple dynamics that go on. It's just a bad idea. I'm actually for reducing the number of mandated reporters based on my own experience and those of other people. Expanding it is just bad.
Thank you. Thank you. Does any commission member have any questions based on the testimony you just heard? Okay, thank you very much. That is the last person I have in my queue. If any person who has not testified yet would like to testify before we end this meeting, please identify yourself ASAP to me in the chat. Or if you are participating by phone, you can text 781-870-0432. Again, that's 781-870-0432. I'll give everybody a chance to do that while I again recommend that any person who's interested in learning more about the Mandated Reporter Commission to visit the Mandated Reporter Commission's website, which is based off of the OCA's website. It's searchable, it's available online. There's information about our meetings, our meeting minutes, and also there is the public document where we are seeking public comments on the proposals before the commission. And that public comment period, the written public comment period, is operational till April 21st. And we have another virtual public hearing on Saturday, April 17th. That's this Saturday from 1:30 to 3:30, where you can see me again. And if you have any questions, you can email the Mandated Reporter Commission email address, which is also available on our website. Maria, would you like to say anything in closing?
Other than to thank everyone who provided testimony today, we appreciate your taking the time and the effort to make sure that the commission hears a wide range of recommendations. And so I think that if there's no one else in the queue to testify, we will adjourn this public hearing and see everyone again on Saturday at 1:30. And thanks to the commission members who also joined us today, and the interpreters who desperately tried to keep up with folks speaking the way I do, very fast. So we thank you very much, and we look forward to seeing all of you again on Saturday. Thank you.